Our plan included a journey across the entire continent, from ocean to ocean. That was fine, but essentially a quite indefinite plan. We had made it up to Moscow and had discussed it ardently all the way to America. We paced scores of kilometers over the decks of the Normandy, arguing about the details of that journey and dousing each other with geographic nomenclature. At dinner, drinking the pure but weak wine from the cellars of the General Transatlantic Company, we muttered almost senselessly, California, Texas, or something equally beautiful and enticing. But when we stepped onto American soil, everything proved not so simple or romantic. The plan was astounding because of its simplicity. We were to arrive in New York, buy an automobile, and ride until we arrived in California. Then we would turn around and ride until we arrived in New York. It was all simple and wonderful, like an Anderson fairy tale. Tra-la-la sounds the klaxon, tru-lu-lu sounds the motor. We ride across the prairie, we swing over mountain chains, we quench the thirst of our trusty machine with the icy water of the Cordilleras, and the great Pacific sun casts its blinding brilliance on our tanned faces. In short, you can see for yourself that we were a bit touched. In the first place, Taixas is not called Taixas, but Texas. But that was only half the trouble. On the fifth day, the decks of the steamer were filled with suitcases and trunks, unloaded out of the cabins. The passengers moved to the right side and, holding on to their hats, avidly peered into the horizon. The shore was not yet visible, but New York's skyscrapers were already rising out of the water like calm pillars of smoke. An astounding contrast, this, after the vacant ocean, suddenly the largest city in the world. In the sunny smoke dimly gleamed the steel extremities of the 102-storied Empire State Building. On the left side was the small green Statue of Liberty. Then suddenly, it was on the right side. We were being turned around, and the city turned around us. Finally, it stopped in its tracks, impossibly huge, thunderous, and quite incomprehensible as yet. We had not informed anyone of our impending arrival, and no one met us. We waited under our letters for the customs clerk. Finally he came. He was a calm and unhurried man. He was in no way affected by us having crossed an entire ocean in order to show him our suitcases. He politely touched the upper layer of our belongings and did not look any further. When we finally freed ourselves, it was already evening. A white taxicab with three gleaming lanterns on its roof, looking like an old-fashioned carriage, took us to the hotel. Our attempt to take a look at New York from an automobile failed. We drove through quite dark and dreary streets. From time to time, something rumbled hellishly under our feet, or something else thundered overhead. Whenever we stopped before the traffic lights, the sides of the automobiles that stood beside us hid everything from view. The chauffeur turned back several times and asked again for the address. It seemed that he was somewhat anxious about our English. Now and then he would look at us patronizingly, and his face seemed to say, "Never mind, you won't get lost. Nobody ever got lost in New York." We liked the room, but we did not pause to explore it. Hurry into the street, the city, the tumult. We threw our overcoats on the couch, ran out into the narrow corridor covered with a patterned carpet, stepped into the elevator, and the elevator, clicking softly, flew down. We looked at each other, significantly. After all, this really was a great event. For the first time in our lives, we were about to walk in New York. At once, a slight misfortune befell us. We thought we would walk slowly, looking around attentively in order to study, to observe, to take in, and so forth. But New York is not one of those cities where people move slowly. The people who passed us did not walk, they ran. And so we, too, ran. From that moment on, we could not stop. We spent a whole month in New York, and throughout that time, we were constantly racing somewhere at top speed. Simultaneously, we acquired such a businesslike and preoccupied air that John Pierpont Morgan Jr. himself might have envied us. At our rate of speed, he would have earned approximately $60 million during that month. We earned somewhat less. We stood at the most popular corner in the States, at the corner of 42nd and Broadway. The Great White Way, as Americans call Broadway, stretched before us. Here, electricity has been brought down, or brought up, if you like, to the level of a trained circus animal. Here it has been forced to make faces, to hurdle over obstacles, to wink, to dance. Edison's sedate electricity has been converted into Duroff's trained seal. The surge of Broadway carried us several times back and forth and flung us into a side street. We walked again through some slums and again did not know where we were. Young men in light-colored hats crowded around drugstores exchanging curt phrases. Their manner was exactly like that of the young men in Warsaw who populate Krasnaya Street. In Warsaw, a gentleman from Krasnaya is not considered exactly God's precious little lamb. It is sheer luck if he turns out to be merely a thief, for he might be something much worse than that. Late at night, we returned to our hotel, not yet disappointed with New York, nor elated over it, but rather disturbed by its hugeness, its wealth, and its poverty. We left the hotel to lunch somewhere, and soon found ourselves on 42nd Street. During our first days in New York, no matter where we were bound for, we invariably landed on 42nd Street. Over the large show window of a corner store, despite the sunny morning, gleamed the blue letters, Cafeteria, in electric lights. Generally speaking, New York is remarkable because it has everything. There you can find the representatives of any nation, secure any dish, any object, from an embroidered Ukrainian shirt to a Chinese stick with a bone handle in the shape of a hand, which is used for back scratching. From Russian caviar and vodka to Chilean soup and Italian macaroni. There are no delicacies in the world that New York cannot offer. But for all of it, one must pay in dollars. And we want to talk about the preponderant majority of Americans who can pay only cents. The splendid organization of the restaurant business seems to confirm that. Model cleanliness, good quality of produce, an extensive choice of dishes, a minimum of time lost in dining. All that is so. But here is the trouble. All this beautifully prepared food is quite tasteless, colorless in taste. It is not injurious to the stomach. It is most likely even of benefit to it. But it does not present man with any delights, any gustatory satisfaction. For a long time, we could not understand why American dishes, so appetizing in appearance, are so unappealing in taste. At first, we thought the Americans simply do not know how to cook. But then we learned that that alone is not the point. The crux of the matter is in the organization itself, in the very essence of the American economic system. Americans eat a blindingly white, but utterly tasteless bread. Frozen meat, salty butter, unripe tomatoes, and canned goods. Near New York, we saw waste places overgrown with weeds, forsaken plots of earth. No one sowed grain there, no one raised cattle there. You see, we were told, it simply would not pay. We cannot compete here with the monopolists from the West. Somewhere in Chicago, in the slaughterhouses, they kill cattle and transport the meat throughout the country in frozen form. From somewhere in California, they ship frozen chickens and green tomatoes which are supposed to ripen in transit, and no one dares to challenge the mighty monopolists to a fight. Sitting in a cafe, we read McCoyan's speech, which said that food in a socialist country must be palpable, that it must bring joy to people. And it sounded like poetry to us. While in America, the business of feeding people, as any other business, is built on this single consideration: does it pay or does it not pay? Therefore, people eat frozen meat, salty butter, and unripe tomatoes. Some businessman discovers that it pays to sell chewing gum, so people are taught to chew this cud. All the while we were there, we felt an irresistible desire, common to all Soviet people, to complain and to offer suggestions. We wanted to write to the Soviet control and to the party control and to the Central Committee and to Pravda, but there was no one to complain to, and there is no such thing in America as a book of suggestions. The American writer Ernest Hemingway, author of the recently published Fiesta, which evoked much discussion in Soviet literary circles, happened to be in New York while we were there. His permanent home is at Key West, a small town at the extreme southern tip of Florida. He proved to be a large man with mustaches and a peeling sunburnt nose. He wore flannel trousers, a woolen vest, which did not come together on his mighty chest, and his bare feet were in house slippers. We stood together in the middle of one of the hotel rooms in which Hemingway lived, engaged in the usual American occupation. In our hands were high and wide glasses of highballs, whiskey mixed with water. So far as we have been able to observe, everything in America begins with a drink. We happened to talk of Florida when Hemingway at once passed to what seemed to be his favorite theme. During your automobile journey, don't fail to visit me at Key West. We'll go fishing there. And with his arms, he showed us the size of a fish one can catch at Key West. That is, like every fisherman, he spread his arms as far apart as he could. The fish must have been about the size of a sperm whale. We bought a new Ford. At first, we wanted to buy a Ford with a radio set, but we were dissuaded by a terrible story. Not long ago, an accident occurred. In the mountains, an automobile was smashed. The wounded people lay in it for several hours under the sound of foxtrots broadcast by the surviving radio set. After hearing that, we refused to buy a radio. The machine glided over the damp asphalt of Central Park West. The speedometer began to register miles. We started on our long trek. The proud towers of New York were behind us. Framed in stainless steel, the facets of the Empire State Building shone in the morning murkiness, hovering over the gigantic city. Now, we were driving through a lively and unpretentious suburb. Muddy water ran over the pavement, which was lined with parallel strips. The high-strung people of New York raced in their automobiles on their sundry errands. In a red brick house, toasted sandwiches were sold. As a matter of fact, all the houses here were brick and all were red. What can one like here? What can one learn to love here? Like all the large cities of the world, New York is an appalling city. Here, millions of people bravely struggle for mere existence. There is too much money in this city. Some people have too much, while others have too little. And it is this that casts a tragic light on all that happens in New York. We parted from the city for 2 months. The roads, like the roads of ancient Rome, are built practically for all eternity. Among the millions of automobiles flying from ocean to ocean, we too were a grain of dust, chased by a gasoline storm which has been raging for ever so many years over America. Our machine raced past rows of gasoline stations, each of which had 6, 8, or even 10 red or yellow pumps. We stopped in a small town and dined in a drugstore. It is necessary to explain here the nature of a small American town, and what sort of drugstore it is in which one may dine. When America's big businessmen, in search of profit, directed their attention to the drug business, they were first of all curious to find out what pharmacists were really doing behind their partitions. What were they grinding there with their pestles in those thick china mortars while frowning importantly? Was it medicine? Well, now, how many medicines are there in the world? Let's say 50, 100, well, 120 at the most. Why then prepare them in an amateur way in drugstores? They should be produced in mass quantities in factories. The fact that medicines began to be prepared in factories didn't make it any easier for the sick man. The medicines were no cheaper. But the pharmacists lost their income. That was taken over by the drug manufacturers. To recoup their lost incomes, the outsmarted pharmacists began to sell ice cream, thirst-quenching waters, small notions, toys, cigarettes, kitchen utensils. In a word, they went in for anything at all. And so the present-day American drugstore is a large bar. Although the drugstore has been long ago converted into an eating establishment, its proprietor is nevertheless obliged to be a pharmacist and have a certain baggage of learning, which is insistently indispensable while serving coffee, ice cream, toasted bread, and other drugstore merchandise. America is predominantly a country of one-story and two-story houses. The majority of the American population live in small cities where the population is 3, 5, 10, 15,000. Every small town wants to be New York. There are New Yorks of 2,000 population, there are New Yorks of 1,800. We even found one New York consisting of 900 inhabitants, and it was a real city. Its inhabitants walked on their Broadway, their noses, high in the air. The architecture of the buildings in the principal street cannot present the eye with artistic delights. It consists of brick, the frankest kind of brick, laid in two-story cubes. Here people make money, so there is no room for artistic embellishments. Many of the rebellious writers of America have come from the small towns of the Middle West. Theirs is the revolt against sameness, against the deadly and futile quest of the dollar. Some of the towns make heroic efforts to distinguish themselves from their brethren of the same type. Signs are hung at the entrance to the town, quite, let us say, like signs over the entrance to a store, so that the customer may know what is being sold where. Redwood City, and under, in verse, is written, "Climate best, by government test." Here they trade in climate. The climate may be the best, but the life is the same as in the cities that have no splendid climate. An automobile journey across America is like a journey across an ocean, monotonous and magnificent. Whenever you go out on deck, in the morning or in the evening, in a storm or a calm, on a Monday or a Tuesday, you will always find water, of which there is no end. Whenever you look out the window of an automobile, there will always be an excellent smooth road with gasoline stations, tourist houses, and billboards on the side. You saw all this yesterday, and the day before, and you know that you will see the very same thing tomorrow, and the day after. And the dinner in the state of Ohio will be the same as yesterday's when you pass through the state of New York. It is in this consistent sameness that the colossal dimensions and the incalculable wealth of the United States are expressed. Before saying about Eastern America that this is a mountainous or a desert or a forest land, one wants to say the main thing, the most important thing about it. It is the land of automobiles and electricity.
Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.